Hello, I'm Chris Alvarez, and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today's episode is a crossover episode with my science fiction podcast. In this episode, the discussion revolves around the NASA space program and associated military topics. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Science Fiction and the Fantastic Inside Out. Today I speak with Mel Croft and John Yuskowskis, who've written a book, Come Fly With Us, which is about NASA's payload specialists on NASA missions going up into space. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Mel Croft and John Yuskowskis, authors of Come Fly With Us, NASA's Payload Specialist Program. So thank you both for speaking with me.
Thanks for having us.
So first, tell me about the... how did you get into studying and writing on this subject? And I guess, John, you can start.
Well, Mel and I both kind of grew up, I think, following the space program. I certainly did, watching all the shuttle launches on TV back then. And over the years, I saved a lot of magazines and articles and books, and we've read a lot of that. We're both members of a website called Collect Space. Mm-hmm. And that's where we made the contacts, where we initially got into writing our earlier book, which was Footprints in the Dust, mm-hmm. with Outward Odyssey series through University of Nebraska Press with Colin Burgess down in Australia. Mm-hmm. So we got very lucky to get involved in that project, and that just naturally led to, what are we going to do next? And I think Mel can give you a better idea how this project got started.
Colin contacted me, asked me if I'd like to write a book on the payload specialist. It took me a couple days to look at it before I said yeah. And then I told him I don't want to do it alone. So he said, why not work with John Yuskowskis, and we'd work together and become friends. I said, fantastic. So it worked out great.
Okay. So tell me then about the subject matter of the book and how you sort of lay it out. How do you address the topic? And I guess, Mel, you can start with that one.
Yeah, it's a good question, because we want to start with how the payload specialist came to be. Mm-hmm. And so the first chapter is strictly the genesis of the payload specialist, and it was a very interesting story. So I attend a lot of events with astronauts, and I knew some of the ones from the early shuttle days, and I said, I'll just ask them how it started. Mm-hmm. And I did, and they looked at me and said, I don't know. We just flew them when they told us to fly them. And I said, uh-oh. But I found a lot of NASA memos, mm-hmm. at University of Houston Clear Lake Archives, which just spelled it out all through the 1970s into the 80s. So that's the subject matter itself of the payload specialist. Began with Space Lab. If you're familiar with that, would you like to expound on that? Space Lab?
Sure.
Well before Apollo was over, Wernher von Braun from Marshall Space Flight Center was astute, and he said, we can't continue to survive as a center that develops rockets and builds them. So he put together a group called Program Development of about 100 people and said, define our future. And what they eventually came up with was what became Space Lab. It was an evolution. It started out as a research and applications module, sorting modules, but eventually got into communication with ESA, the organizations that became ESA, European Space Agency. Mm-hmm. And that's how Space Lab came to be. And Marshall, once the shuttle was approved in, I think, December 1972, they were awarded control of Space Lab. And like any good organization, they took the ball and ran with it. What kind of experiments were we going to do in Space Lab? The planning of those experiments and selecting their own astronauts, which eventually became to be called payload specialists. And John, you may want to comment on the military guys, how they weren't started out as payload specialists, but that's how they flew.
Yeah, the Air Force had they kind of came in to save the program at one point. The Carter administration was going to cancel the space shuttle. They just canceled the supersonic transport and the B-1A program. And this is going to be the next program on the chopping block. And it was the Air Force that came along, Dr. Hans Mark and General Jack Culpa, that offered it to infuse some money into the program to keep it alive, and then be able to fly military payloads on the shuttle as well. So all the classified reconnaissance satellites, once that decision was made to have the Air Force involvement, naturally they wanted to have their own people fly on these missions as well. So they selected a group in top secret circumstances to a group of 13 engineers to fly with those payloads and integrate them into the shuttle. So that's where it started on the military side. But even prior to that, going to the title of the book, Come Fly With Us, that's actually a quote from Ken Mattingly. Mm-hmm. Back in 1982, they had just finished the flight test program of the shuttle. And Mattingly and Hartsfield were doing a tour of the country and went over to the Paris Air Show. And Mattingly would always end his speeches with that phrase, come fly with us. And I happened to be there in Baltimore, Maryland when they came to town, and I was about 14 years old at the time, and I remembered him saying that. Mm-hmm. And it discussed titles, that sales pitch came to mind, and that's really what it was a sales pitch, because they were trying to sell the space shuttle mm-hmm. to all these potential customers to fly satellites and payloads and invite foreign countries to come in and fly their payloads as well. Mm-hmm. So his phrase was kind of an invitation to the world to come fly on the space shuttle and really at that time also see that America was superior to the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Now, when
those people who flew on all those people who flew on those missions flew as payload specialists.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess for either of you, what are some of the issues you touch on in the book that you haven't mentioned yet? Like, you know, special things about the about payload specialists that people would find really interesting.
You know, let me start out with that. What I found very interesting is that, I mean, these are astronauts, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody, they walk out of the checkout and operations building, they're dressed like astronauts, they're real astronauts. But when Marshall started their planning and decided they were going to select their own payload specialist to fly, because they had, they were current in their science. They were, you know, they come from the university. When Johnson Space Center found out about it, namely, mainly Chris Kraft, it was, well, hold on, Marshall. You know, we have experience planning science missions, Skylab, and I think we put some people on the moon too. And, we also have a lot of astronauts, so we really don't need your astronauts. So what I found, there was this, I won't call it a battle, but definitely a back and forth between Marshall and Johnson about, do we need payload specialists at all? And Johnson didn't think so. But what was interesting is that the back and forth was not so much between Marshall and Johnson. There were some, but it was mainly Johnson Space Center and headquarters, with Chris Kraft trying to convince headquarters that we don't need their payload specialists. And that went on for half a decade. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity to speak with Skylab astronaut Joe Kerwin about 2015, and we were talking about this issue, and we went through some of the things that happened. He said, but you know, it just kind of worked itself out. Hmm. So eventually what transpired was that the payload crew doing all this experimentation in space were comprised of two payload specialists and two mission specialists from, and obviously the mission specialists were from Johnson Space Center. So it worked out well.
Hmm. Interesting. And John?
Well, I think one of the things I found most interesting in talking with all these folks, we interviewed quite a number of them, was the different walks of life they all came from, and the fact that they all found a seat on the space shuttle from so many different backgrounds and so many different paths they took through life to get there, and many of them weren't even really preparing for that. Some of them had a dream to do that in the past. Some of them had applied to be astronauts themselves and had been turned down on multiple occasions in one case that I know of. But they kept finding a different route to get there, and they had that tenacity to find a different path. So people like Charlie Walker went to McDonnell Douglas and got involved with a program, an experiment called electrophoresis that had a lot of promise early in the space shuttle days, and he flew with that payload three times. Folks like Bob Senker, who was a RCA engineer, he had applied twice and gotten turned down. And then he amazingly got a phone call from his boss one day and said, hey, remember that payload specialist position we were talking about? How would you like to go fly on the space shuttle? Hmm. So it's just amazing how all the different ways these folks found their seat on the shuttle. And then we can talk a little bit later about their different reactions to doing that, both during the flight and later on in life.
I was actually curious, in the book, do you touch on STS-51L, Lima?
Yeah, it was a tough chapter to write. It had to be included. You know, we couldn't bypass that. But an interesting thing is we did a lot of this research and writing in the 2015-2016 timeframe, and that happened to be the 30th anniversary of the Challenger accident. Mm-hmm. So rather than we took a different approach to that chapter. I tried to tell that story from the perspective of some of the folks that we had interviewed. Where were they when it happened? What was their reaction to it? What are their opinions to it 30 years later? Mm-hmm. I think we did a pretty good job without getting too much into all the technicalities. The story does concentrate on the people involved, Greg Jarvis and Krista McAuliffe, how they came to find their seats on the shuttle. Mm-hmm. And everybody's read about the explosion and the reasons behind it. Mm-hmm. We didn't get too much into that. We tried to focus on the individuals, and I think telling it from the perspective of the other folks that got to fly was a good way to do it. An interesting side story to that is that Congressman Bill Nelson flew on the flight just prior, and there was a time where he was actually assigned to 51L, so he was going to fly on 51L with Krista McAuliffe, and he was exchanged with Greg Jarvis, who was going to fly on the mission prior with Bob Sinker. Hmm. And that decision was made, as Sinker told us, really to split up the two non-astronauts and the two space industry people. So you had two satellite engineers on 61C, the mission prior, and you had two non-space people, Krista McAuliffe and Bill Nelson, on the subsequent flight on Challenger. Mm-hmm. And they decided to mix up those two pairs of payload specialists so you could have somebody kind of leading the way and showing the other one the ropes. Mm. So kind of an unfortunate turn of events that led to Greg Jarvis being on that mission. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like he was bumped for the politician. That wasn't the case. He had been removed previously from another flight for Jake Garn, but that didn't happen in the case of 51L. Mm.
So you did mention you wanted to talk about the reactions some of these people had when selected. I guess, Mel, you can start on this one.
Oh.
Or are you the wrong? Should I ask John about that?
No. No, I remember very well because Jake Garn comes to mind. He was a savvy politician, senator from Utah, and, you know, he pretty much told NASA he was, well, head of the Appropriations Committee that was handling the money. So he kept telling NASA, I want to fly. And it became a litany. He had people running interference for him. Every time somebody came to Washington, he would go and say, yeah, I want to fly. Other people would tell the administrator, Jake Garn wants to fly. And I don't know if he ever really expected it to happen, but I remember when he was finally called and told, well, was it told? I think he was told in person. He said, here's this politician that can stand up and pontificate with anyone. And as soon as he was told, he was speechless. His jaw dropped. And it was, really? That's how I would react.
Yeah, yeah. John?
Yeah, I think they all reacted how any of us would if you won that ticket to Disney World, as it were. Sinker comes to mind as well because he got that phone call, and his boss wasn't exactly up front with him. He just said, okay, I'll get back to you. So Sinker hung up the phone, and he's sitting there going, I can't work anymore. What am I supposed to do? You know, so he turned around and marched up to the boss's office and walked in and said, you know, what's going on here? What do I have to do? And he goes, well, just relax. We haven't even chosen your backup yet. And he was just incredulous. He said, my backup? You know, I'm flying? He goes, yeah, you're flying. So, you know, like I said, it's just really interesting the different ways that they found out about it and even learned about the opportunity to begin with. One of the things we mentioned in the book, too, is Greg Jarvis came across just a flyer that was thumbtacked up to a bulletin board. Mm-hmm. And it said, wanted payload specialist to fly on the space shuttle. So how would, you know, can we even relate today to a situation like that where you're walking down the hall at work and you find a flyer that sounds like a cruise advertisement that says, hey, how'd you like to go to space? And that's how he found out that there was a chance to do it. So it was an amazing time. And I think we've all kind of, we hope that the readers get that from the book is like, wow, do you remember back when all these things were possible with the space shuttle? And, it all ended with the Challenger, of course, but, those were really heady days and it was a really exciting time where it was almost to the point where they were trying to convince the American public that any of us could go.
Mm-hmm. Was there
can I throw one more in?
Sure thing.
Byron Lichtenberg, who flew on STS-9, Space Lab 1, he was not selected as an astronaut, I believe, two times. And then he went back to MIT and got involved in a project there that was working on space adaptation sickness, you know, the space sickness or space adaptation syndrome. And he got involved in that and was selected as a payload specialist. And that ruffled the feathers of some of the other mission specialists who were selected in that group eight of astronauts. Lichtenberg flies before them. And they weren't really happy about it. Kathy Sullivan was very upfront about it. Here I get selected the right way, and here this guy goes and flies before me. So,
well, so I'm curious, were they under added pressure to do sort of to prove themselves worthy?
I don't think, I think there was, people were looking over their shoulder a lot. But once they're assigned to a crew, it seems like all the crews really took very good care of them. They all got together as a crew and bonded as a crew. All of the controversy that you read about in the book and the conversations back and forth about is this a good idea or not, none of that happened with the actual people involved in flying. They got with their crews and they were treated as an equal from day one. You know, there were a few confrontations here and there, but that all happened in the office. That never happened as part of training, and it never happened during any of the missions. Everybody got along really well.
Okay. When Charlie Walker first got introduced to his crew and started working with him, the commander, Hank Hartsville, told him he had to cook all the meals. He was pulling his leg, but Charlie didn't know it. He said, "Not a problem. I'll do that."
So you mentioned, I saw your list of questions. Sorry, what's the present? Actually, let me step back a second. As far as physical requirements, did they have to train, you know, keep in shape on their own personal time? You know, how did they handle that part?
Well, John, they had, as a class 3 medical, you're the aviator. Talk.
Yeah, third class medical, the way one of them put it to us was, as long as you, they could hold a mirror to your nose and they saw fog on it, you were good to go. And they would joke about things like, you know, most of your training consists of what not to touch in the orbiter when you get up there. But different ones took a different approach to it. Some of them weren't necessarily in great physical shape, and other ones, like Bill Nelson, took it upon himself to prepare himself as much as he could so should the opportunity ever arise. And he went up in F-15s and F-16s and pulled Gs in those to try and build up a G tolerance and get some experience in flight on his own. And then he jogged like mad, I believe. And but other ones didn't do any of that kind of thing. They each found their own way to do it. I think the Air Force guys were a different group and approached that differently too. Of the all the manned spaceflight engineers selected, only two of them were rated pilots. So they were the only ones that were subject to a medical previous to that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, interestingly enough, because of the delay in shuttle and the delay in launching Space Lab, the ESA astronauts were invited over to do mission specialist training in that interim time frame, Vubu Ockels and Claude Nicoye. But they passed the NASA physical. Ulf Merbold, who actually flew on STS-9, couldn't pass the mission specialist physical, so he could not go and participate in the training. But he could still fly as a payload specialist.
So what about the current state of payload specialists? You mentioned in your list of possible questions commercial flight. You know, how is that all integrated?
Well, right now, this year we should see the flights of four commercial spaceflight providers, two of those being suborbital with Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin, and then two of those being orbital with SpaceX and the Boeing company. Now Boeing and SpaceX are going to be tied up for a long time doing crew transfers up to the International Space Station. They have a contract with NASA. But I think in the future they would be doing orbital flights for paying passengers, and by paying passengers that could be a university or a corporation that just leases out the spacecraft for orbital experiments, and they take their own people along. So they likely won't call them payload specialists, but they'll essentially be doing the same function that the guys were back in the 1980s. Right now, Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin have both flown NASA payloads already, unmanned. But I think eventually those payloads are going to be tended by people, just like you see now flying on the Sophia 747 and these days they use the 727 for zero gravity payloads. Mm-hmm. All those kind of researchers that do that stuff today under university grants or through NASA programs, they'll be doing that on suborbital spaceflight, and it'll really take off here soon. And I hope to see those first flights this year.
Mel, anything to add to that?
No, I think John put it well.
Okay.
I will say that I think if we go forward, you're going to see a wide variety of people flying who would be similar to a payload specialist. And at one part of the time of the book, I actually compared it to Star Trek. There are lots of payload specialists on the USS Enterprise. They know how to, fix the dilithium crystals or fire a phaser. They had basic training. They did something else. So they were payload specialists.
Interesting point. So I'm trying to get an understanding of how they operated when they were in space. I guess they weren't doing any spacewalks or anything. Were they just in the bay doing their work, or how did that go?
Well, for Space Lab, on those missions, that Space Lab was comprised of a pressurized module, but it could be flown with just a series of pallets in the payload bay without the pressurized module. So when they had the pressurized module, there were four payload crew persons, two payload specialists and two mission specialists. So they were 12 hours on, 12 hours off. So for one 12-hour period, a payload specialist and a mission specialist were in the Space Lab module, and you didn't see them up in the orbiter. They were busy doing their experiments, and the other crew persons were sleeping at that time, or the payload crew. And then they would swap. I do recall that pilot Brewster Shaw told me that he and John Young on SCS-9 would occasionally venture down into Space Lab where the scientists were working, and they would get down there, and it was basically, don't touch that. Would you get out of the way? Space Lab, they stayed pretty busy. Interestingly enough, on one of the flights where we flew the Saudi prince, he flew because we were deploying a Saudi Arabian satellite to bring the Muslim world together for communications. And turns out they didn't plan enough work for him. So he would get his experiments done, taking pictures mostly, and then he had nothing to do, and he became bored. And he wasn't really happy that he was a little bit critical afterwards. NASA should have put together more work in here for me. I don't think I would have gotten bored. But.
Yeah, and that was an interesting aspect that we found too, is that even though a lot of these folks were chosen as they were signed on as part of what they called launch services associated with the payload. So if your company or your country would sign up to fly your satellite, you got to send somebody with it. And that was a big competitive advantage over like the Ariane Corporation. You couldn't fly your guy with the satellite, and you couldn't bring it back if something went wrong either. Another big sales pitch for the shuttle. But once in orbit, the satellite deployment itself was actually the responsibility of the mission specialist from NASA. So the payload specialist that was there because of the satellite in the back had no direct responsibility for the payload unless something went wrong and he could possibly help troubleshoot it. So as a result of that, they had to find a lot of secondary payloads and experiments for them to do. They got kind of relegated to doing a lot of medical tests in the mid-deck. And in the case of Bob Sinker, he had an infrared camera that he was testing that used what they call a staring focal plane, which is basically what you find in every digital camera today on the market. But back in 1985, it was brand-new technology. So he was primarily responsible for that. Another interesting payload specialist that flew, though, was an oceanographer, Paul Scully Power. He was from Australia originally, and he'd been here with the U.S. Navy for a number of years. And he actually advised the NASA astronauts on how to take orbital photography of eddy currents and large-scale features of the oceans. So NASA had long talked about flying an oceanographer, and Paul Scully Power and Bob Stevenson were both selected to do that. And ultimately, only Paul flew. But he spent as much time as he could in the flight deck, upside down, up by the flight deck windows. So the wraparound windows in the front were kind of like a gondola to him. He called it the gondola mode. So he would float upside down and see what was coming and know what he was going to get to photograph. and then slide over to the other side and be able to take a picture of what he was aiming for. Huh. So he was a unique guy, and he had a unique opportunity on the shuttle that most people didn't get.
I want to turn to how many total number of payload specialists were there?
For the scope of our book is primarily up through the Challenger accident, and John, there were 22 who flew during that time, I believe.
22, yeah.
Including Chris McAuliffe and Greg Jarvis. I counted up the total number 1 point, and I can't give exact number, somewhere between 50 or 60, I believe, who ultimately flew.
Okay.
As payload specialists.
And did each one have a backup, or were these also including backups?
No, those were the ones who actually flew, and most of them did have backups, yes.
Oh, okay. 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 What resources did you use for your research? I assume plenty of interviews, but if you can address anything else you used.
Boy, when I found the archives at the University of Houston at Clear Lake, I was a sigh of relief because I didn't know how I was going to tell the story of how the payload specialist began, and there in front of me in hundreds of memos, it was just laid right out in front of me. Mm-hmm. Letters from memos from Christopher Kraft up to headquarters. I could read off a whole list of names that I'm sure you'd recognize and their input into the program. Mm-hmm. A lot of information on the internet, obviously, and books. And then the favorite part of it was talking with the astronauts. And fortunately, I had the opportunity not only interview some of the payload specialists and backups, but to talk to some of the crew persons that they flew with. Mm-hmm. which was just as insightful to get their perspective on the programs. Mm-hmm. And again, I'll have to, like John said earlier, once the payload specialists were assigned, the professionalism of the NASA astronauts came through. They wanted their mission to be successful, and that included the payload specialists being 100% successful. Mm-hmm. So very impressed with those NASA astronauts.
And John?
Well, like I said earlier, I had a stack of magazines from when I was a kid, and there was some really fine reporting done back in those days before the internet, Countdown magazine, Space World magazine, publications like that. I saved them for years, wondered what I was ever going to do with them, went through a move and still kept them, and then one day this project came along, and I had some validation for keeping them all those years. So that was a good start. The interviews were great. Some more than others. Some of these guys were just so cooperative. They wanted to, in several cases, they wanted to see the chapter when it was completed and make their own edits. So they wanted to make sure the story was right too. Mm-hmm. And I told them it was their story. A lot of the sections that I write, it's mainly based on interviews and has a lot of quotes. And they wanted to make sure that was right. And I had no problem with that. Mm-hmm. That's ensured the accuracy for me. The Air Force guys in particular, I drew the what we thought was the short straw, being the pilot of the pilot and scientist pair here. I got the Air Force program, and we didn't think those guys were going to talk to us. I didn't think I had any chance at all of hearing from them, being that a lot of the work that they did is still classified. But once I got a hold of the first one, it kind of snowballed from there. He called somebody else, called somebody else, and I got a reputation as the guy who was writing the book. So it got to a point I had to cut it off. I couldn't take any more information. Mel, I'm sure, remembers my first cut at the Air Force, just the chapter on 51C, the first classified mission, was 25,000 words. Okay. And the book was limited to 120,000 words, so we had to cut a significant portion of that. So they were all just wonderful guys to work with, great patriots, real gentlemen, and they have a alumni group out at Los Angeles Air Force Base out there called the Special Projects Alumni Association. They were part of, Air Force parlance, it's the Secretary of the Air Force Special Projects is the name of their group out there. So that alumni association was a big help, too.
So considering all that, I know that, you know, you have limits as far as how large the book can be. I'm sure you have a lot of good historical or pretty awesome historical information that you couldn't use. You know, what happens with that? Where do these interviews go? Where does that extra stuff end up?
Good question.
we thought about writing a follow-up book, and we could just never come up with something that we thought would be approved. Mm-hmm. And then we came up with another idea and kind of went in a different direction that's still kind of secret, I guess. But
Okay.
But certainly we're going to preserve it, and I hope we can still be champions. Interesting enough, I was invited to the Marshall Space, well, not to Marshall, to the Huntsville Rocket and Space Center by one of the Space Lab scientists that I interviewed for the book, Rick Chappell, who was at the beginning of Space Lab and was a mission scientist on Space Lab 1. And although John mentioned some of the later Space Lab flights after Challenger accident, we really don't have time to get it, didn't have time to get into in detail. It turns out that, at Huntsville, Valerie Neal from the Smithsonian, she's a historian, she was there, and they're kind of tossing around the idea now of, well, maybe we should tell the story of those other missions in a separate book. So hold on, there may be something that pans out there, I don't know yet.
Did either of you get a chance to interact with any of the physical items associated with this history, you know, with the just anything that you were able to just see close up or hold or anything like that?
Sure. We went down to I've been to the Kennedy Space Center several times, actually, to initiate some contact with the payload specialists we wanted to talk to. And while you're there, of course, the space shuttle Atlantis is on display. But we did a dedicated research trip to the Uvar Hazy Center at Dulles, the Smithsonian Annex there. Mm-hmm. Space Shuttle Discoveries there, the first Space Lab module that they flew in Space Lab 1 and a number of other missions is there. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, around the back of that display, it's not something a lot of people really notice, but there's a lot of Space Lab gear behind there, including the instrument pointing system that was used on Space Lab 2 for the solar physics and the astronomy studies that they did on that mission. So it doesn't look like a whole lot.
Yeah.
To us, it was a gold mine to go there and see that equipment firsthand. And if you go to our Twitter page, and we've shared that link with you, you can see some pictures of us there during the research trip. And that's also, you mentioned before, where does the other information go that we didn't get to use? There's a lot of material on there on the Twitter page that we're calling the cutting room floor. So some of the quotes and some of the stories we weren't able to fit into the book, we're trying to share on there as well.
And one outcome of me going on to Marshall, and I'm going to take credit for this, even though I probably don't deserve it. Harry Kraft, who was a mission manager for Space Lab 1, I met him. He showed me around the Space and Rocket Center. And it's all Apollo stuff, mainly, or some Skylab. And Valerie Neal was there. And during our conversation, I kept asking Harry, where's the Space Lab stuff? He goes, well, we don't have any. And the conversation kept going on. He asked Valerie, how come we don't have any here? She says, well, you should. So they developed a conversation whereby maybe Uvar Hazy will loan them some of the Space Lab hardware for the Huntsville Museum. We'll see what happens.
Interesting. So this is for each of you. What part of the research was most enjoyable? I guess, John, you can start.
Well, certainly talking to the guys. There's a lot of things that they spoke with us about they hadn't thought about in a long time. And I think they appreciated the opportunity to do that. And they got to think of some things they hadn't thought of in a long time. And I think it was a good experience for them. Maybe somewhat surprising that somebody was interested in the story and how we were telling it and some of the feedback we've gotten from them. It means the world to us to hear back from these guys. We sent them all copies of the book. And to hear the complimentary remarks back from them just I know Mel's kind of beside himself at times getting to talk with these guys that kind of grew up watching as they did their space flights.
Yeah.
That's an easy question to answer. I have two responses. One, an example of what was fun. And doing the research for Space Lab 1, I found a memo where for the single – there was an ESA payload specialist, Ulf Merbol, and there was one American slot for a payload specialist. And they had the list narrowed down to 18 candidates. And on that list was Dr. William Thornton, who was a NASA scientist astronaut chosen way back when and also a mission specialist. So I started thinking, did he submit his name to be a payload specialist or did Johnson submit it? Did Marshall ask for his name to be submitted? So I sent him an email. And a couple of days later, I got a response. He said, you know, it's a good question, but I'm working on my own project. I'm busy. I just don't have time, so I apologize. Okay, well, I appreciated the response. 30 minutes later, I get another email from him. He says, you know, Melvin, he called me. He said, that is such an insightful question. I don't know how you came up with it, but if you'll call me, I'll give you an answer. So that was just classic. The other is at the University of Houston, finding all these memos. Literally, I'd send them ahead of time to have a database, what I wanted, and they'd have four or five carts lined up, bringing them out. But when I ran into comments of on NASA memos, handwritten comments by astronauts like John Young and Ken Mattingly, and some of them were hilarious. I was the only person in the room, and there were two offices with employees, and I was just jumping up and down and talking to myself, and I know they were looking at me like I was an idiot. But this stuff was just classic. Mm-hmm. So that's where I had the fun.
So now you mentioned, both of you mentioned stuff that you found that was interesting. What did each of you find that was most surprising in your research? John?
Most surprising? I think the reactions of each one of them to seeing the Earth, they were all very different. I've mentioned before that most of the astronauts go up and they speak about how fragile the Earth looks and how thin the atmosphere looks, and that's a valid observation. I think most people will come back and explain it the same way. Bob Sinker spent the whole last night in orbit just watching the world go by at the overhead windows instead of sleeping. So he spent 8 hours or so, I think, watching all phases of the Earth going by with moonlight and sunlight and thunderstorms, sunrises and sunsets. So he had a very insightful description of that, because he was upset that he wasn't going to be able to share that with his family. Most places he had been in life, he could say, "Oh, my son would like this," or "My wife would like this," but he didn't. He knew he was someplace where he was never going to be able to take them.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting take on it. And then, in contrast to that, Bill Pales, one of the Air Force manned spaceflight engineers, he looked down at the Earth as being very rugged and very vibrant and not fragile at all. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of surprising to hear that contrast between the two views. He's probably the only astronaut I've ever talked to that expressed it that way, that he didn't have any concerns for the Earth being fragile at all.
Mm-hmm.
And not that he said you shouldn't take care of it,
right,
and all the environmental concerns are valid, but he didn't see it being that fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that surprised me the most.
Yep, Mel?
I think the thing that stands out to me is the dedication of these people and the professionalism. An example is Charlie Walker on STS-41D, the first flight where payload specialists flew with that electrophoresis, or Cephas, they called it, equipment. His equipment was down in the mid down below, not up where the windows were. And his fellow crew person said, you know, he hardly ever came up to look out the window. He was down there the whole time babysitting that Cephas device. We had to force him to get upstairs and look out the window. I mean, it probably would have been the opposite for me. And the other thing along those lines is the people connection. Some of the comments made by the NASA astronauts, you would have thought, boy, they hate this payload specialist concept. And maybe they did, but they didn't dislike the people. John Young, who was very much, I won't say against it, but kind of negative on the planning. Turns out he became very good friends with the ESA payload specialist Ulf Merbel for life.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's that people connection.
All right. I'll start with you, Mel, with this question. What question or issue was the most difficult to come to a conclusion on, or maybe is still an open question for you that you wish you had been able to figure out or solve?
That's an easy one. Yeah. I set a goal before writing the book to answer a question about a payload specialist who flew, well, not wanting to give the mission, but a payload specialist that had some problems in space.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that the commander became so concerned that he put a padlock on the hatch of the site of the orbiter to make sure he didn't open it up. He was that mentally depressed.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know the real story. The story that I was given didn't make sense. Where did the commander get a lock from? They just don't carry extra equipment on the shuttle.
Right.
So I found two pieces of information that I think settled the issue as much as need be. One, I found some what's called transcript profiles that is an attempt to transcribe all the ground to space communications in the space lab module.
Mm-hmm.
And I had read accounts where, well, let me back up. They were talking about Dr. Taylor Wang on STS-51B. His dynamics module, when he went to turn it on, he spent 5 years working on this on the ground, got into space and turned it on. It didn't work. And NASA told him, "We don't want you to try to fix it because it's very unlikely." Well, he became very depressed, and he admitted that after the mission. But I was told he spent 3 or 4 days after they finally allowed him to try to repair it, he spent 3-4 days repairing it. Well, that's not the case, because I've got the exact timeline. The whole episode lasted for just a little over a day, and there were some concerns by those on the ground with the, based on the comments I got, such as prayers for Wang and things like that. So something happened up there. Mm-hmm. But I talked to Fred Gregory, who was the pilot on that mission. And Fred's comment to me was, well, first of all, there was no lock. There was no lock, but the commander did secure the hatch with duct tape. But Fred iterated time and again to me, he felt the commander Overmeyer way overreacted. Wang was a great guy. He worked hard, and he finally got his equipment working and persevered. So I don't think it was nearly as big an issue there as people made it out to be.
Hmm. Interesting. And John?
One of the overriding topics we wanted to cover throughout the book was the subject of risk. Hmm. We asked each one of the guys who flew about their perception of the risk at the time versus their perception now. And I think they were all aware of it. None of them were specifically told about the problems with the solid rocket boosters, but none of the NASA guys were either. So at that time, nobody really had any concern that the problem, the issue hadn't really percolated up to the level of the astronaut office, so not too many of them were aware there was even an issue. But each one of them took their own approach to evaluating the risk, and they were used to, some of the people who were already in the space business were used to doing risk assessments for equipment, but then came the day where they had to walk out on the swing arm at 195-foot level and go out to the orbiter hatch, and they had to say to themselves, wow, now it's my hide on the line, so am I up to doing this? And I think most of them had made that decision long before they ever got to that spot, but there were certainly some moments of reflection when they got out there and looked down at this rocket that was, you know, steaming off liquid hydrogen and oxygen, and it was creaking and moaning and making all kinds of noises. Mm-hmm. It's a different vehicle than it is when you just go out and tour the launch pad or something like that. Mm-hmm. But they each had their own way of addressing that and dealing with it. But you do hear when you talk to the guys, both the professional astronauts and the payload specialists, that there's a little bit of maybe some anger about what they weren't told. So that's still there, and it's still painful for a lot of them. And some of them can just tell you exactly without mincing any words exactly what they thought about it. Mm-hmm. And other ones are more reserved. But risk was a big thing. The military folks took it; they were more adept to that. And I think most of the manned spaceflight engineers who didn't get to fly didn't agree with the rationale for ending their program. And that was that the risk was too high. And most of them had signed up, as they put it to me, that with the understanding that they were going to eventually one day put their lives on the line for their country. Mm-hmm. And they never got the opportunity to do that. So when the higher-ups came and said, you're not flying in space because it's too risky, they didn't really accept that too well.
Yeah, I get that. And either of you can answer this one first. What did you discover that had the most emotional impact on you, either negative or positive?
I think I would share the story from the Dutchman Vubo Ockels. The man was just truly touched by flying into space, and it impacted him for the rest of his life. And one story that I recall is that at the end of the mission, he and his fellow payload specialist and ESA astronaut Ernst Messerschmitt were back watching the payload doors close. It was described as a very beautiful moment. And Vubo said, I'm going to go get my camera and take some pictures. And Ernst grabbed him by the hand and said, no, don't. Just stand here and enjoy this moment. And afterwards, Vubo said, I sure am glad he had me do that, because that was a special time.
Hmm. John?
Well, the Challenger topic was especially difficult to deal with, and there was a lot of emotion in talking to the guys about that. Even people who weren't astronauts and folks that were just involved in the management side that we spoke to, still some raw emotion there. But I think emotion-wise, one of the best quotes I got for the book actually turned into a title of one of the chapters from Gary Payton. One of the best descriptions I've ever heard of going uphill on a space shuttle. He said, you get to about 10,000 feet and you go Mach 1 going straight up. And it, as you do that, the airplane and the rocket that it's riding on are vibrating so violently, he said he felt like he was going supersonic in a paper airplane. I think that's the best description I've ever heard of riding that space shuttle. It's not just vibration from the rockets. It's actually what he called the vibroacoustical environment around the orbiter. So the sound itself is actually shaking the vehicle, not just the thrust of the rocket. So he was very... very concise in describing what that was like, but then he threw out this quote, and I was like, well, that's going to be the title of that chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did the DOD affect shuttle design? Are you talking about the physical configuration, or you were talking about the missions that you had mentioned before?
Well, in a lot of ways, when the Air Force came to the Carter administration and essentially bailed out the shuttle program in those early days, their requirements to fly the DoD payloads are really what dictated the shape and the size of the orbiter that we see today. The 60 by 15 foot payload bay was sized to fit not only the KH-9, the Hexagon spy satellite, into, which is declassified now, but it was actually designed to fly even larger payloads that are still classified today. So that payload bay, once that size was determined, then they had an additional requirement to fly into polar orbits out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. So the problem with that is that if you launch into a polar orbit going southbound out off of California, in order to do an abort to come back around and land at the runway, that runway is moved about 850, 900 miles off to the east by the time you come back around. So you have to be able to reenter and then make a turn using those big delta wings back to the west coast to be able to land. And that's what created the need for those large delta wings on the shuttle that you see today. The original concepts were more like light lifting body designs, and those delta wings came from the Air Force requirement for the polar orbiting missions. But the engineers that were selected, that first group of 13, fascinating bunch of guys, and they were thrown into a situation where the Air Force and NASA and even some people within the program offices of the Air Force that were developing the satellites, a lot of them didn't want anything to do with the shuttle. So there was a lot of controversy going on back then, a lot of arguments, and they were just thrown into it and said, go do what you got to do. Go integrate these satellites into this shuttle payload bay and let us know how it goes. They weren't given a whole lot of guidance. So a lot of things like hold down clamps and the vibrational environment around the shuttle, they had to develop sensor packages to measure that on some of the early flights. So their contributions to the program early on really are the unsung part of their of the shuttle program, I think. The manned spaceflight engineers did a lot of time training as spacewalkers in the water tanks down at Marshall before they built the facility down to Houston. So we've got a photo or two in the book of the Air Force guys in old Apollo suits doing that underwater training. Well, they weren't training to do actual spacewalks. That would be the area of expertise for the NASA folks, but they were doing experimental work as far as what could be built in zero gravity, what kind of components could be changed out on satellites, could you refuel a satellite in orbit to extend its life longer. So they were doing all that early experimental work that led to successes like the Solar Max recovery and repair, and later satellite retrieval and repair missions. And I don't think they ever got a lot of credit for that. We hope the book brings that to light a little bit.
And how did these individuals handle being called astronauts for the rest of their lives, or still, you know?
Yeah, I think they all handle it their own way. Some of them really don't get out in the limelight much. Other ones kind of openly embrace it, and they'll do public appearances, and they'll throw on the old blue flight suit every now and then, and go out and sign autographs. And to most of the kids that they see down there at like Kennedy Space Center or Houston, they don't mind the difference, and they don't feel the need to explain the difference. Other ones have kind of shunned it. I know Bill Pales from one of the Air Force guys. He always referred to himself as an Air Force astronaut. He says when he's out in public, he doesn't say I'm a NASA astronaut. I wasn't a shuttle pilot or anything. He says I was an Air Force astronaut, and that to him sets him apart from the rest. So they all handle it their own way, and there's not a lot of fame that comes with it. It's kind of like they're famous for brief periods of time when they do a public appearance, but as soon as they take off the jacket or the flight suit, then they're just another businessman or lawyer in the hotel bar.
I'll share an observation from some of the events I have attended with lots of astronauts there, and Charlie Walker attending. Of course, Charlie flew three times. But when you see Charlie interacting with the other astronauts, including shuttle and Apollo era astronauts, it's pats on the back, hugs, not just regular handshakes, big handshakes. And you look, this guy's an astronaut. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been accepted. But when I wrote the chapter on 41D, his first mission, and Charlie reviewed it for me, I wrote in there that Charlie became an integral part of the astronaut course. He said, oh, you can't say that. He made me take that part out. He said, no, that I'm not. So the observation is that he is, but he still didn't feel that he deserved that.
So you touched on, both of you have touched on this, but what do you hope the book will ultimately do? And John, you can...
Well, I think it sheds light on a previously unknown aspect of the space shuttle program. I know everybody can look down a list of crew members and say, okay, payload specialist. What we try to do is tell their story from a very personal perspective, but also kind of highlight how much their contributions meant to the success of the program. Ultimately, it was a successful program that went all the way up through the Columbia accident. Ilan Ramon from Israel was the last payload specialist that ever flew, but not out of necessity. It was just that was the only flight that was a research flight that was squeezed in between all the space station assembly missions. So once the space station assembly began in earnest, there really wasn't a need for payload specialists to go up and do any of that kind of work. So it ended there, but I think it would have ended anyway. But I think I would hope that in the future now, when these other folks go up on the commercial spacecraft, that they might look back and say, wow, this is the same way I got started in my line of work. So this is kind of like an early history of what we're about to see come in the future. And I think we're just right now in the middle of a brief pause in the kind of work that the scientists and researchers do in orbit.
Mm-hmm. Mel?
Yeah, I'll share a story from one of my friends who's a tremendous space buff, I met him attending these space events where we talked to astronauts. He knows a lot about space. And when he found out I was, had written the book at that time, he asked me what it was about. I said, the payload specialist. And it was, well, what is that? I said, well, you have to read the book. But I gave him a quick description. He said, gee, I just thought they were all mission specialists. So here's a very knowledgeable person about space travel, and he wasn't even sure. The other thing I hope people walk away with, and I wrote the space lab missions, that there was some tremendous heavy-duty science done on space shuttle and space lab. And we try to touch on it just enough to show people that there was some really good work done that paid off. And I'm sure it's what they discovered is impacting us to this day here on Earth, material science and so on. I'd like people to know a lot of that started with Space Lab, and it's continuing on with the space shuttle. It actually started with Skylab. It was continued on big time with Space Lab. Well, when I say space shuttle, let me back up. It was started with Skylab, continue with Space Lab in a big way over much longer term. And then a lot of what they're doing is being continued to do on the space station now.
The current, the Air Force's experimental sort of smaller size shuttle, I guess, is maybe the best way to call it. I'm sure you're both aware of it. I can't imagine a situation where they might use military payload specialists, you know, military personnel who aren't trained, you know, who aren't specifically trained to be astronauts but need to go up to accomplish whatever mission. I don't know. Any comment on that or anything you've come across?
Well, we spoke to the guys about that, and the X-37B is an automated space plane. It spends hundreds of days at a time in orbit doing undisclosed work up there. They call it a technology development platform. But, you know, in reality, it's probably doing something more than that. It has the ability to change its orbit, and I think even change the plane of its orbit. So it's really unpredictable when it comes over a certain location. And I don't think you'd have that capability without intending to fool somebody as to when it's going to be there. So as far as what technology they're developing on there, that remains to be seen. But Gary Payton in particular pointed out that currently today, you know, the MSC program came after other failed programs like the X-20 Dinosaur and the MOL, the Manned Orbiting Laboratory. So there had been a multi-decade argument in the Air Force as to there being a need for humans in space for a military mission. And I think the MSCs were there as payload integrators more than they were actually performing any kind of reconnaissance mission from orbit using the space shuttle. They came to do some things later on that would examine that, but once they ended that program, to this day, they haven't really found another mission for a man in space. And today, with technology advances and the robotics advances, it's probably less likely that they're going to find a mission for a person to perform in space that a robot couldn't do. Now that could change. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on the requirements come down the road, who knows what kind of threats they're going to have to deal with in space down the road. But for now, there's just not a need for a military mission up there.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think any of us know what this new, is it Space Force? Is that what it's called? The president is touting now? Who knows what that's going to look like? Mm-hmm. But you never know.
Yeah, it could be very interesting. Can either of you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book finished and published and how you overcame them?
Word count. 45,000 words.
Yeah.
That was the most difficult part. John?
It turns out we're very wordy writers. It was to tell, and it was a difficult decision to limit it to just those first couple of years of the shuttle operations. If we would have done this, you know, throughout the whole 30-year history of the mission and tried to cover all the payload specialists, it would have been a very impersonal story. It would have been a kind of a chronological, this guy flew here, this guy flew there, they did this and this, and it would have been a very rushed story. So we made that decision early on to limit it just to those up to the Challenger accident and then just highlight a few notable missions after that, like John Glenn's flight on STS-95. But, the toughest part was just trying to contain it all within the space that we had.
Our contract was for 100,000 words. So we finished at 185,000. Mm-hmm. And somewhere they let us stop at about 140 plus.
Mm-hmm.
Said that's it, guys.
Well, you gave them more than they asked for, right? Isn't that a bonus?
That's the way we saw it.
So you mentioned the Twitter account. Where can people find both of you online, websites, social media, whatnot?
Well, we're both regulars on that CollectSpace website. Like I said, Robert Perlman manages that. I've been on there for probably 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a thread going on there. You can follow us there. And then we have the Twitter account. That's Come Fly With Us Book, at Come Fly With Us Book. But the Come Fly With Us is shortened to CMFLYWITHBOOK, USBOOK. And we sent you the link for that. You can post that up when you post the story. And that's where we have a lot of photos from our research, and we've got all the cutting room floor material. And we do a lot of other stories about the payload specialists that we couldn't fit into the book. It's been we've got a good number of followers now, and we'd be happy to have some more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that's all the questions I have. Do you guys have any final thoughts or words?
I always have thoughts. I think it was a tremendously successful program. Some of the NASA astronauts were very skeptical of it early on, but I think most of them came around. But you look at what we did. We did a tremendous amount of science. We did some great military work, some of which I don't think we still know the results of.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of international goodwill, I think, with some of our foreign partners to get them up and build some connections there. So I think it was just a tremendously successful program, and I'd like to see it something similar to continue in the future.
John?
Yeah, I agree. It's a great, great program, probably one of the unsung programs, issues that do with the shuttle. And it was a real honor to write about it. It was an honor to talk to these men and women that were part of it. And we hope that they appreciate their story being out there as much as we enjoyed writing it.
All right. Well, thanks again for speaking with me.
Chris, thanks for the invitation. It's fun to talk about this stuff.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.